Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Laura Morelli, art historian, professor, researcher, and historical novelist of numerous award-winning publications. Laura holds a PhD in art history from Yale University, an MA in art history from Tufts University, and she graduated from the University of Georgia with a BA in Romance Languages and Literature. Laura has taught college students in the U.S. and in Italy, and currently produces art history lessons for TED Ed. She authored a column for National Geographic Traveler called The Genuine Article, and has contributed pieces about art and authentic travel to CNN Radio, The Frommer's Travel Show, USA Today, Departures, and other media. Laura is the author of the popular authentic art guidebooks that include such titles as Made in Italy, Made in France, and Made in the Southwest. Her debut novel of Venetian artisans set in 16th century Venice, The Gondola Maker, won an IPPY for Best Historical Fiction and a Benjamin Franklin Award. Her second novel is a prequel, The Painter's Apprentice, published in 2017. Laura's innovative and richly written style skillfully brings art history to life in these engaging stories. Here to speak with us from the art historian's perspective on the art of writing is Laura Morelli.
Hello, Susan. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You have a strong foundation of art historical and literary training from renowned universities. Can you tell us about your background and what inspired you to become an art historian?
I actually grew up in a very rural part of Georgia in the southern area of the United States. And when I was a little kid, people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I always said I wanted to be a writer and an archaeologist. And I feel incredibly fortunate that I got to do more or less what I was thinking when I was 4 or 5 years old. Not many people can say that. But writing about art and history did become my passion and my calling and what I was really put here on this earth to do. But it was really later through travel and specifically through study abroad that I was really pulled to study art history as a graduate student. And I started out wanting to be an art history professor, and I did teach at the college level for many years before I turned to writing full time. What sort of sparked my curiosity during my graduate school years in art history was that even though I had studied all of the great masters of art history, all of those names that fill the art history textbooks, Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, et cetera, there were actually a lot of living artisans in Italy and France especially who I discovered were carrying on the torch of tradition and passing on traditions that were still very much alive, things like glass blowing and pottery and even really interesting things like bagpipes and gondolas that had been going on quietly for 500, 600, 700 years. And it was those living traditions that really sparked an interest and pulled me toward writing for a more general audience and educating a more general audience outside of the university.
So, like a visual artist, you have an innovative style of creating a story, and with your own unique language that brings art history to life, what is your process, and how do you see your writing skills have developed and grown?
Well, I think that the analogy of a visual artist is a really good way to describe at least my fiction writing process. I'm a big outliner, and if you think about it, a visual artist might start a project with a series of preparatory sketches, for example, with a pencil and paper. It might take a painter, for example, several passes to work out a composition for an overall picture. They might use pencil and paper, they might use pen and paper. Later, they might move on to a pastel sketch or a watercolor to work out the color. And only later do they then perhaps turn to a canvas and begin to mix their oil paints and start to work in oil and canvas. And for me, writing fiction is kind of a similar process of layering or, you know, putting clay on top of an underlying wireframe structure that I've sort of tweaked and moved around. So I begin with a really high-level skeleton or outline, and eventually that turns into a very detailed scene by scene outline. And it's only after I've worked out the arc of the story that I begin to draft individual scenes and parts. Now, truthfully, most of the time I do end up departing from that outline to some degree. The story takes a life of its own. But at least for me, beginning with the end in mind is a roadmap that helps me get started and move in the right direction.
And you spent a number of years visiting and living in Europe, Italy and France, observing, researching the cultures, and speaking with the descendants of some of the Renaissance craftsmen. How did these experiences contribute to your captivating style of connecting our history and people's stories of the times for your readers?
Well, I think that art history is really about stories and people, not much more than that. And sometimes truth is stranger than fiction. And I love those stranger than fiction stories, that they really make the best nonfiction books and documentaries, things that you couldn't make up because they're so good. But other times, especially once you begin to study art history seriously, you realize that some stories or pieces of stories are lost history. And for me, that's an exciting place because that's where the imagination takes over and that's where fiction begins. So, for example, the first work of fiction that I did is called The Gondola Maker, and that story germinated inside my head while I was busy working on a nonfiction book called Made in Italy. And those contemporary artisans I mentioned, those that I interviewed one after the other, continued to tell me how important it was for them to pass on their knowledge to the next generation. And I began to wonder what would happen if the successor were not willing or able to take on that duty for some reason. And the characters of the gondola maker and his complicated son began to take shape in my head. And this story intrigued me so much that I felt compelled to imagine it based on those facts that we know of history.
And how did you come up with the idea for a prequel for it in The Painter's Apprentice?
The Painter's Apprentice takes place a generation before the story of the gondola maker. And there were a few things that came up in the process of writing The Gondola Maker that I, even as the creator of the story, wanted to learn more about and know more about. And so I went back to explore this gondola maker's previous generation and the painter's previous generation. And 16th century Venice is such an interesting place and time from an artistic point of view. It was the moment when people began to transform from painting on panel to painting oil on canvas. So artistically, there were a lot of interesting things going on. And then there were a lot of challenges too, like the bubonic plague that was particularly bad in Venice. So a lot of really interesting background and cultural aspects of the time that drew me to continue writing about that particular period and place.
And as a historical author, is there a lot of research material you'd like to include in your novels, but find many of the details end up on the editing floor? And how do you keep a balance?
Yeah, you know, I ended up with my latest novel creating a separate website where I posted a lot of that background research that ended up on the editing floor. And certainly as an art historian, reading a novel is wonderful, but I always then want the visual. So this website was a place for me to put all of those images and a lot of the background research and bonus material that I thought might interest readers if they wanted to go further. So there's a link in the back of each one of my historical novels where you can go and see a lot more bonus material and behind the scenes historical context that I think most fans of historical fiction are interested in.
Can you tell us about a project that you're working on currently?
Well, I just finished a novel that is a little bit of a departure for me. It's actually a dual timeline story that alternates back and forth between the 15th century and World War II. Many people don't know that during World War II, the Nazis stole every known painting by Leonardo da Vinci. And my latest story is the story of Leonardo's Lady with the Ermine, which it was one of the most coveted paintings among high-ranking Nazi leaders during World War II. So that book is on its way to publication, and I'm currently finishing another book that is a fictionalized story, but it's based on the creation of Michelangelo's David.
Do you like to keep a lot of different projects going at the same time? And does that help you keep some of your ideas flowing?
Yes, I like to typically have a fiction project going and a nonfiction project going. And I find that if I get stuck somewhere on one, I can sort of shift gears and work on the other one. And it serves as almost like a palate cleanser. And the nonfiction comes more easily. It's a completely different animal. Writing fiction and nonfiction are completely different. And so shifting back and forth between the two kind of helps balance and keep the other one fresh, I think.
And how do you market your books and get your message out to readers?
Well, today there are a lot more opportunities than ever. And at the same time, it's challenging to make your voice heard above the noise that we live in our world today. But certainly social media is a great way to connect with readers, and being involved with other writers, especially other historical novelists and people in my nonfiction field, has been really important in terms of marketing. You know, many people don't realize that only a few years ago, authors really had no direct contact with their readers at all. We had layers of publishers and booksellers between us and our readers. And it was only with the advent of social media that we were able to talk with our readers in real time and get feedback and get to know them. And that is incredibly valuable and enjoyable as an author. So we're very fortunate to live today and have these opportunities that we've never had before.
And what do you like your readers to come away with after reading your novels or your nonfiction series?
Well, I think that if people can feel either educated or entertained or inspired by my work, then I will have felt satisfied and like I've done my job. You know, there's so much noise and negativity in our media. If I can help someone escape with a great story, whether it's a true story or something that's based on history, then I will have considered myself to have succeeded.
And with your knowledge of the many opportunities possible for art historians and writers, what would you advise students interested in following a path in the field?
Traditionally, people who came out of graduate programs in art history either went into academia or into the museum field, and those positions are, of course, still certainly available and in place. What's exciting now, though, I think, is that technology allows unprecedented opportunities for anyone who is able to think outside the box. And so I think that's incredibly exciting. If you have a message or that you want to spread or a project that you want to work on, this is an exciting time. You can make the world a better place without the layers of bureaucracy, without a publisher, without a classroom, without a university, without even an employer. You can work directly with people who want to hear your message. And that is something that technology has enabled, and I think it's incredibly exciting for anyone who's willing to think outside the box. And certainly artists usually fall into that category, so it's a great time.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for being on our show. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you all the best on your upcoming projects.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. It was a pleasure.
That was Laura Morelli, art historian, professor, and author, speaking with us from Buffalo, New York. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Andrew Valko, an accomplished artist born in Prague, Czechoslovakia, where he began his artistic training in a specialized school, incorporating musical rhythm and dance movements. Immigrating with his family to Winnipeg in 1968 at the age of 11, he continued his art education and classes at the Forum Art Institute, then graduated from the graphic design program at Red River Community College. Early in his career, he spent time studying printmaking with Toshi Yoshida at his academy in Japan. Andrew developed unique style and innovative techniques for capturing his ideas and engaging his audience in creative narratives and dialogues. Andrew's work has been in numerous solo exhibitions and galleries across Canada. He has participated in national and international group exhibitions, and his works may be found in a number of prestigious corporate and private collections, such as the Canada Council Art Bank in Ottawa, the University of Manitoba Faculty of Law, the Bronfman Collection in Montreal, the Elizabeth Taylor Collection in Los Angeles, Techbau Technology in West Germany, and more. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
You're a very accomplished artist with an intriguing and innovative collection of works. How would you describe your style of painting?
I guess some people would call it realistic or naturalistic, or it's definitely a mountain is a mountain.
And can you give us an example?
Basically, I work in different series that I've been working with for quite a long time, and the work is realistic. In other words, you can recognize the people, you can recognize the backgrounds, and a recent piece in working with figures using technology to communicate with other people. So a recent piece is a woman standing looking at a cell phone, and she's holding an apple, and behind her is a big screen TV with a Snow White image of the Evil Queen on it.
And you came to Canada from Czechoslovakia as a young boy. Can you tell us about your formative years in an Eastern European culture and how this may have informed and contributed to your artistic vision and style?
Well, I grew up in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and under the communist system. My childhood was kind of interesting in a way that I was, you know, kids in Europe were really left alone, so I spent a lot of time alone, very free to do whatever I wanted. That was a very common thing to do. My parents had a history of being persecuted by different people who rolled through Czech Republic at the time, and they were also at the time being persecuted by the communist system. So I also grew up with a fair bit of amount of tension because I never knew what was going to happen when somebody knocked on the door and those kind of issues. And so how did it inform my work? Because you were under the communist system, I was really, you know, exposed to a certain kind of work. I was not exposed to work from the West. So I mostly saw propaganda art or sort of art from the abstract art that I saw was from the 50s. I was always drawing. I always knew that this is what I was going to do. One thing about the communist system, they recognized when you were doing something well, and they could see that I had some sort of artistic skills when I was very young, so they sent me. Besides regular school, I also went to a special school for the arts, and there I was taught, you know, different techniques and things. But at the time, I was just sort of, you know, drawing all popular things that interested me, like the Three Musketeers and things like that.
When you came to Canada, can you give us a sketch of how you furthered your interest in art and some of your training and educational experiences?
When I came to Canada, my parents recognized that I had this talent, and they encouraged it. And so when I came to Canada, they enrolled me. I took some classes at the old Art Gallery of Winnipeg. And then they enrolled me in Forum Art Institute, which at the time was in Tuxedo. And it was run by Nick Belias. And it was quite a prestigious school at the time. And it had some sort of a, you know, semi-professional people there. And I was enrolled in children's classes. And after two classes, he basically told my parents that I should come in the evening. So I started going. Ever since I was quite young, like about 13, 14, I started going on Tuesday nights and Thursday nights, and I painted with the adults. And I just sat in a corner, and I painted and smoked cigarettes, because they all smoked cigarettes at the time. From there, actually, Nick Elias was quite an amazing instructor, and so I spent all my time there. I really became interested in it, and when I was in the school system, I did, you know, all the artwork for high school, all the musicals, all the yearbooks, all the posters, everything. And then after school, I was sort of tired of school, and I was sort of afraid to go to university. I was sort of uninformed, and I ended up going to graphic design at Red River Community College, which was much different then than it is now. It was pre-computer, so everything was handmade. And I actually didn't know much what I was doing. I just wanted something to fall back on, and that's where I ended up.
What do you draw on now for ideas when you create your series, and do you have any particular themes that you like to explore?
Well, it just sort of briefly after the Red River Community College, it was an interesting place. We did take art history, and I graduated. I worked very briefly for an agency, and at the time there was CKRC Juried Art Show. I painted two paintings, had them submitted. They bought one. Somebody else bought one. I ended up with $900, and I ended up quitting my job, renting a studio, and then I started working on my own work. Which brings me to your answer to your question. You know, it took me a number of years. I went through many different phases and things to get to what I do now. I was always searching. I always knew sort of what I wanted to do, but it took me, you know, a number of years to sort of find my own language. And once I found it, I started. My first sort of hint of series was a beach series, which sort of showed people communicating and body language on a beach, because I used to spend a lot of time in Hawaii and stuff. And then I moved on to my first really serious series was the Motel series. And that led from one to the next. You know, from there I went to the Drive-In series. From that I went to the Technology and People series and Women with Guns series. And those things I've been sort of fooling around with for a number of years now.
So as your work became increasingly innovative, how did you capture textures, light, and colors in your work?
I was always interested in, you know, representational type of work. I really enjoyed abstraction, but it wasn't really for me. It didn't really fit my personality. And so it's something that you develop over the years. I mean, it takes quite a bit of time to perfect what you're doing in creating a realistic piece of work. And I was always interested to have the piece done to a point where it really supported my ideas. So I was really trying to make it that the viewer could get absorbed into the piece and that there was nothing that would hinder what the ideas were. In other words, if it was a room that was lit by one light bulb, I really wanted to make sure that everything was had this beautiful yellow glowing light so that the person would really feel that room. And those were the kind of things I tried to achieve, and that took a number of years, and I'm still working on it. I mean, you're constantly progressing.
How would you say you accomplished the longevity in your images so that the viewer can continue to create stories and interpretations from your work?
You know, I was always interested to create a painting that had longevity. In other words, a painting that when you put it on your wall, you wouldn't take it for granted that it had sort of open-ended ideas that you could look at it 10 years later and you would say, oh, what if this is happening? What if that is happening? And that was always my interest, is to sort of create this piece that would entertain forever. And the ideas that I was dealing with, I was trying to say certain things, and the things I was trying to say, I didn't necessarily want to express a story that was obvious. In many cases, I don't really know what the story is. I sort of create certain tensions and hints and, you know, put certain clues in the paintings, and then I basically feel the viewer interprets it in their own way. But I definitely leave it sort of open-ended, so it could be one thing or another, you know, depending on who really looks at it and how they interpret it.
How does your work explore the relationship between people and today's technology?
Well, I'm sort of really interested in how people are communicating with technology today and how they communicate and see the world around them. And I could explain one painting. Let's say, have a woman who's standing in front of an open laptop, and she's just lit by the laptop itself. And she's standing there, and in her hand, she's holding a little piece of paper, and there's a note on the paper that says, I love you. So obviously she's communicating with somebody, and she's wearing just her underwear. So she's obviously communicating with somebody on the computer, and I just find the interesting thing how people today communicate through these machines rather than communicating themselves. In other words, I have people texting me, asking me things, and I'm always thinking, well, why don't you just phone me? Like, why are we texting back and forth? And I text young people to say to phone me, and then they'll phone me in a sort of like, hello? Like, and then you realize that they have this phone, which they don't use as a phone ever. They just use it to text or to do different things with. And so there's so many issues around that. So a lot of my paintings talk about that. And also, you know, talk about sort of intimate relationships between people on the phone. Like, I'm sort of fascinated with the dating apps, and I just find it bizarre. And, I mean, I understand it, and I understand the purpose of it, but I also find it very sort of strange. So, you know, a lot of the paintings are about that.
Early in your career, you went to Japan and you studied the printmaking. Can you elaborate on that experience?
When I was young, I was sort of exploring different things, and I ended up working at Moosehead Press, which was a sort of an artist printmaking place in Winnipeg for a period of time. And I met Noburo Sawai, who was a Japanese professor. I think he taught in Calgary, and he was a printmaker. And he talked about, you know, printmaking in Japan and stuff. Anyways, I ended up in Asia, and I decided to stay in Japan and find the studio where he worked at that he mentioned. And I sort of, without really, I just had the address, and I showed up there. And it was a school run by Toshi Yoshida, who was the son of Hiroshi Yoshida, and they were national treasures in Japan. And Toshi Yoshida was then in his, he must have been in his 70s then, or late 60s, and he really wanted to take the Japanese style of printmaking and teach it to Westerners and sort of, you know, spread it around the world, because it's a different type of printmaking than a Western type of printmaking. I showed him my sort of portfolio, and he says, yes, you can come to the school, but you have to come in 2 weeks because there was enough students. And again, I was told, I was young, I was totally naive. I just sort of showed up on his doorstep. And then I ended up studying there for 5 months at one period, and then I went, came back to Canada, and then I went back again. I went back 3 times for long periods of time to work with him and the different printers in the studio. And so, anyways, that sort of led me to obviously carving into wood and using printmaking techniques, because that's how it works. And then when I came back to Canada, I did continue printmaking, but I sort of was standing around once, and I was carving a block, and I thought, that'd be kind of interesting to use that in a painting process. And so then for a number of years, I started carving into the surface of the painting. So the paintings were done on an MDF board or plywood, and I would carve the surface. I also, you know, ended up doing irregular paintings. So there were shapes that were carved out of plywood or MDF boards. And so for a number of years, I did carving paintings, which actually I stopped doing the real relief carving, but I still do, to this day, I score some of the surfaces in some of the lines in the painting. So I don't do any more three-dimensional carving, but I do still do linear carving into the surface of the panels.
Do you have any new series coming up or exhibitions that you're excited about and would like to share with our audience?
I am going to be in a group show in New York with the Maisel Gallery at the end of February. That is really the new sort of exhibition coming up, the latest thing. As far as one-person exhibition, I don't have one planned immediately, but sort of discussing with the gallery in New York that possibly we'll do a one-person exhibition after that.
Well, I'd like to wish you good luck in that exhibition in New York, and I'd like to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Andrew Valco, an accomplished artist practicing here in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.